Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall, October 9, 2005, on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on an absolutely lovely and spectacular fall Sunday. Today we've got a terrific guest for you, someone I wanted to have on, one of the great political satirists and novelists of our times, author of Wag the Dog, Larry Beinhart, our guest today, to talk about his new book, Fog Facts. It's a show I think you're going to really enjoy, so please stay tuned. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Several hundred people packed an auditorium on the campus of the University of Iowa on Wednesday, October 5th, to express their displeasure with media consolidation to Democrat FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. The town meeting, co-sponsored by Free Press, was designed to collect public comment that can be put into the record as the FCC considers a second go-round at revising media ownership rules. Most of its first attempt in 2003 was struck down in court. Public comment at the meeting ran for more than 3 hours, with the vast majority of speakers lamenting the erosion of diversity of voices and viewpoints to be found on TV, radio, and in print. For his part, Jonathan Adelstein expressed sympathy with the public's frustration and told the assembly that he would push for formal FCC public hearings on media ownership before the commission took up any further revisions to the rules. Similar town meetings on the future of media have already been held in Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Oregon. At least one more is in the works this year, slated to take place in Asheville, North Carolina.
A new report from the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office calls the White House and the Education Department on the carpet for spending millions of dollars to monitor and influence reporting on education issues. Specifically, it finds the Bush administration did break federal anti-propaganda laws by funding initiatives that constituted covert propaganda. These include the government's $250,000 contract for favorable spin from conservative columnist and commentator Armstrong Williams, at least one video news release produced by a fake reporter on contract to the Education Department, and a project involving the mass monitoring of media outlets to see if Republican-specific talking points were making it into print and on air in a favorable fashion. Unfortunately, the Government Accountability Office is only an advisory body with no power to prosecute, and earlier reports from inspectors at the Education and Justice Departments stopped short of acknowledging any illegality.
As the federal government debates how to reorganize the electromagnetic spectrum to accommodate new digital technologies, lots of money will change hands in the process. The biggest beneficiary is expected to be the federal government itself, which, through auctions of spectrum, expects to raise billions of dollars for the national treasury. However, claims might be made that the government does not have exclusive ownership of the spectrum nationwide. Roanne Robinson Shaddix of the Native Networking Policy Center says none of the treaties between tribes and the government mention anything about spectrum ownership. Previously, Shaddix was chief of staff of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, a government agency which, in conjunction with the Federal Communications Commission, oversees the division of spectrum use.
There are several tribes who are talking about how, through treaties, they never ceded the airspace. They see this as a natural resource, and it's not one that they specifically ceded. And so there's a lot of discussion going on about how do you make the legal case and to demonstrate that tribes are owners of that airspace and should be compensated for any auctions that go on.
As of yet, though, there are no test cases in the pipeline to challenge federal control of the spectrum.
The Second Circuit Court of Appeals breathes new life into an antitrust lawsuit brought against the nation's dominant phone companies. The lawsuit accuses four companies, Bell South, Quest, SBC, and Verizon, of working out secret deals to carve up the country into regions in which one company would dominate. Thanks to this arrangement, the four now provide some 90% of all local phone service in the United States. A lower federal court had initially tossed the lawsuit, but the Second Circuit decided there was enough substance to its claims to go forward, although the three-judge panel declined to comment on the case's merits.
In the battle over file sharing, the music industry is finally getting a taste of its own legal medicine. So far, the Recording Industry Association of America has filed lawsuits against more than 13,000 people it accuses of sharing copyrighted songs online. Now, one of them is countersuing. 41-year-old Tanya Anderson says she's never even downloaded a song, yet the RIAA allegedly tried to strong-arm her into a settlement by paying a hefty fine. What's worse, Anderson's lawsuit claims the RIAA has hired a private company to hack people's PCs, just one of several tactics the industry reportedly uses in its anti-sharing crusade. If so, that is blatantly against the law. One of those most recently targeted in court is a 14-year-old girl. This after a lawsuit against the girl's mother was dropped by the industry after she signaled she would fight the case. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall. Sunday, October 9, 2005, here in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a great guest for you today. In the annals of Hollywood films, there are only a small number of truly hilarious and brilliant political comedies. Our guest today is the author of the book that became one of them, Wag the Dog. Our guest, Larry Beinhart's written several books, several novels and screenplays. He's also written essays that have appeared in Newsday, the LA Times, International Herald Tribune, Esquire, and on and on. He's noted and commented upon as a truly gifted writer. And he has a new book out, Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin, just published by Nation Books, about politics and media today. It is a pleasure to welcome Larry Beinhart to Media Matters. Larry?
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor.
Well, the honor is ours. You know, I picked up this book, as a matter of fact, I was with my daughter looking at a college last week, and I was in a bookstore, and I picked it up, and I couldn't put it down. And I mean, I was reading it in the bookstore, and I felt guilty, so I ended up buying it.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, but it's such a great book, and it's written so well. It's the sort of, it's truly, I've used the term a lot, page-turner, for some of the authors who come in the show. This book is sort of the standard that all others will be measured by.
Wow, thank you very much.
Well, it's quite true. Let's get right into what the book is about, if we can, Larry. Fog Facts. Why did you write this book?
You know, it's the first book I've ever written in my life that somebody actually asked me to write. Fog Facts was a phrase that came out of my last novel, which was called The Librarian. And that was about an election that turned out to be just like the one we had. And the notion is that there are thousands and thousands of facts out there. And it's hard to figure out which one's important. And so it's like looking at drops in the mist. And all you see is the mist. And fog facts are like that. And we live in a media environment in which facts only become important if somebody makes them important. And so a lot of really significant things disappear. One of the first ones that I talk about in the book is on 9/11. After 9/11, the FBI leaped into action. And it was just like on a TV show. You know, within 3 days, they told us all 19 guys, and they published the pictures. Within 10 days, 2 weeks after that, seven of those 19 guys called up, or their government called up, places like the BBC, the New York Times, the LA Times, and said, excuse me, I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if they were alive, they weren't on the planes. And so we leap forward 3 years, and we get to the 9/11 Commission report. And the 9/11 Commission report lists the same 19 people without even acknowledging. I mean, it's possible that, you know, maybe these guys were all lying, I mean, or somebody was calling up. I don't know that. But the 9/11 Commission did not even address this. They let these facts, which were published in very reputable places, completely disappear into the fog. So that's one kind of fog fact.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, as I progress in writing about this and examining the situation, I kind of discover more and more about it. I just had an article in Editor and Publisher. And
by the way, for those listening, that article is available at commondreams.org if you want to go online.
Right. And what had happened was I'm driving along, and I live in upstate New York, and I'm listening to NPR. And I hear a very well-done story about the events in Lake George, where it's a great tragedy, and I think 20 people died. And the reporter there had really covered it. He discussed everything there was to know about this accident, the kind of boat it was, whether they had bucket seats or bench seats, whether the guy was drunk, which he wasn't. He had called around the country and spoken to other reporters who had covered similar accidents, some of them as many. I think one was like 15 or 20 years ago. This was hugely well done. And it was a very ordinary story. It was kind of what you expected. And then a week earlier, I had been reading this story about our majority leader, Bill Frist, who had been charged with insider trading. And that story was completely bare bones. All it said was the guy had been charged, and it listed his denial. And I'm wondering why they didn't fill in the blanks. Why is this insider trading? Is this typical behavior? It's a very odd situation. We have both the president and the vice president of our country. Both were insiders in companies where they were in a position to know that their company's next report was going to reveal terrific weaknesses that the public did not yet know. And yet they both sold their stocks in that situation, made a lot more than if they had waited. So that's one dimension of the story, is that it seems to be a common theme in the top ranks of our government. Another issue is that...
So those are fog facts in your...
Yeah, these are fog facts. Because I could find them out. I could go look these things up. But unlike the facts that were pulled out of the fog for this lake story, this tragedy on the lake, they weren't pulled out. They were left in the fog. Also left in the fog was that Bill Frist's money was from a company called HCA. No, I mean, they mentioned HCA, but they didn't say what HCA is. HCA is his family's company, which was charged with and convicted of the largest Medicaid, Medicare, and military health insurance fraud in history. They ended up paying fines and penalties of $1.7 billion. And this is the money that Bill Frist ran for Senate on. He used his own personal fortune. I think he spent $2.4 million, the exact amounts in the article. And plus he used his family's money. So he had run for office on what seems to me to be very corrupt money. And then once he was in office, he became the health industry's man in the Senate. And he continued to put through a series of bills which made himself money, which made his family money, and which made this corporation money. Now, all these things, to me, are facts that the public should know. And so the question is, why aren't they reported in the stories?
And so all fog facts are not created equal. Some things get pulled out in the public. They're brought
into
stories.
Well, then they stop being fog facts.
Yeah, they stop being fog facts. What?
Right.
I mean, the book is a litany of instances like this. Frist obviously is belated to be in the book, which was completed this summer. But we'll go through a number of them. 9/11 is the starting point, but there's a number of cases where you're bringing out facts which are facts. I mean, they're accepted, they're documented, but which are largely unrepresented in news stories on these issues. It would change one's perception of the issues widely were they in the stories. What accounts for what's a fog fact and what isn't nowadays?
Or just how well known it is.
But I mean, why does something become an X fog? Yeah, what makes something a fog fact and what makes something an X fog fact, just a fact?
It's media stories. I mean, except for certain obvious things that have to be covered. You know, Pope dies, a new Pope's elected, somebody wins the World Series, we go to war. President makes a speech. Those things are automatically covered. But once you get past those things, nothing becomes a story. I shouldn't say, most things do not become stories unless somebody is pushing them.
Mm-hmm.
And in especially in the political arena, the media is very frightened for institutional reasons and sometimes for good reasons, of determining for themselves what a story is and what should be included in it. We have a tradition that's called objective journalism, in which very frequently turns out to be one from column A and one from column B. President makes a statement, you go to the loyal opposition. If the loyal opposition doesn't make a contradictory statement or doesn't make a good contradictory statement, there is no contradiction. It simply becomes the litany. What we were talking about in going to war in Iraq. The loyal opposition was afraid to oppose. So the media would take the quote from the president, yeah, we should go to war. And then they would go to the loyal opposition. Loyal opposition said, well, the president said we're going to war. We're going to stand up and salute. And so that's all that got reported. The great fog fact story there is when Colin Powell went up before the UN, and he told us all about the weapons of mass destruction, and he showed the white powder and all that stuff. And nobody, there was a contradiction for it. I'm looking it up as we speak.
Okay.
And nobody in the United States contradicted it. Nobody said, we know there aren't weapons of mass destruction, but what happened is this, and I'm going to read from Brent Cunningham's Rethinking Objectivity. Afterward, General Anwar al-Sadi, Saddam's scientific advisor, appeared to offer a point-by-point rebuttal of Powell's charges. And then on CNN, anchor Paul Azan brought on former State Department spokesman James Rubin to comment. Introducing Rubin, Azan said, you've got to understand that most Americans watching this were either probably laughing out loud or got sick to their stomach. Which was it for you? Well, really both, Rubin replied. The American people will believe everything they saw, he said, referring to Powell's speech. They have no reason to doubt any of Powell's sources, any of the references to human sources, any of the pictures, or any of the intercepts. So here we had the right person, the official person, telling lies. And we had the wrong person, a spokesman for the hated enemy, telling the truth. And our media treated the truth with withering contempt because it had come from the wrong person. In the tradition of objectivity, it is very hard for the reporter to say which is true and which is false. So almost the only guide they have is the standing of the person doing the speaking. And this is just one of the reasons why spin has become so out of control.
You know, Larry, let me interject that the subtitle to Larry Beinhart's book, Fog Facts, is Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin. So this book is very much about spin and its effect upon journalism. You're listening to Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest you've been listening to, Larry Beinhart, the author of the brand new book, Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin. Larry Beinhart's probably better known to many of you as the author of The Librarian, the highly acclaimed novel, which came out last year, and for Wag the Dog, the film of the late 90s, which was a classic in political satire and humor. Larry Beinhart is here. If you want to call in with a question or a comment, the phone number at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And you talk in the book, Larry, a great deal about Iraq, about the build-up to the war, about the Reconstruction, about Guantanamo. It seems like that is an area where we have very serious fog facts. Is that true?
Oh, the war in Iraq is this bizarre myth that exists in George Bush's mind. I mean, you know, yeah, the myth-making and the dishonesty about the war in Iraq go from day one to what we're witnessing today. I mean, it's become very clear. It was actually clear before the war started that going to war in Iraq was something that the Bush administration, George Bush in particular, wanted to do. And it was reported in several places. It was reported in the Secretary of the Treasury's book and in Richard Clark's book. And this is one of the fascinating aspects of fog facts is subsequently, when the Downing Street memos came out, the secret memos in which the head of the intelligence services in Great Britain had gone to the United States and he'd met with the top people in the United States, came back and he met with the Prime Minister of England and his inner circle, and he reported that George Bush and the Americans had determined to go to war, that they had decided that the issues that they were going to go to war on were weapons of mass destruction and a terrorist threat against the United States. Furthermore, that the intelligence did not really support this, so that they were determined to essentially cook the books and find a way to say so. Now, this was big news among lefties on the internet. It was big news in the United Kingdom. It was greeted with vast silence in the mainstream media in the United States. And it was so peculiar that the New York Times, which sets the news standard for what is news and what is not news in this country, ended up writing a story about itself, examining why the Washington Bureau of the New York Times did not consider the secret Downing Street memos to be news. And the essential reason was that it was not news, that everything in them was already known. And this is one of the peculiarities of what I call fog facts, is that if you ask the professionals, the news reporters, historians, political junkies, they can say, yeah, it was reported, and they might even remember the date or the month. But if you ask the American public, did this exist? They'll say, no, never heard of it. So there's a disconnect here between what a reporter does and what its effects are. And the reporter tends to be satisfied with saying, well, you know, I turned in the story, they printed it, maybe it got buried on page 12. That's not my business. Maybe nobody noticed it. That's not my business. My job. I got the story. I reported it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to begin to rethink this. Because what happens is, every time the president says, weapons of mass destruction, we're still going to find them, we went to war to stop the terrorist, they report that. So they report the untruth 100, 200, 400 times for every time they report the truth. They do not, on their own, add every time the president says that. Mm-hmm. They do not add a sentence afterward which says, and by the way, eyewitnesses inside the president's inner circle have said they cooked the books and he knew that this wasn't true.
Larry, let me interject if I can on this point, because one of the most powerful sections in the book is your discussion of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and war crimes and torture and international law. I mean, what are the fog facts out there on those issues?
Well, the big fog fact is that we need to torture people, or that's the framing on it. I think in the president's mind and in the popular mind, we have this fantasy from the show 24. I don't know if you're familiar with it and your listeners are. But in it, my favorite was the second season. The terrorists are going to set off a nuke in L.A. They're going to do it within the 24-hour span of the show. And they have a suspect who will not talk. So it is put to us. Should we torture this guy? Because that will make him talk. And that way we can save L.A. And that is the paradigm on which we are sold. The notion that it's okay to torture people. And the fog facts from reality are as follows. Number one is, we knew enough before 9/11 to have stopped the 9/11 bombers. And we knew it from normal police procedures and normal intelligence procedures. And the real lesson from that is if we had paid attention to what we already knew, we could have stopped it. So the conclusion should be we should pay better attention, not that we should go to war in Iraq or that we should torture people. The next piece of myth that's created is that you will get good information by torturing people. The U.S. Army, I would assume, spent a lot of time torturing people, and I do not mean this as a slur or an insult to our armed forces, but enough so that they were able to write in their manuals on intelligence that it doesn't work. It leads to bad intelligence and no way to check it. People will tell you, you start driving a nail through somebody's hand, and they'll tell you anything you want to hear. I mean, they'll just say, oh, sure, I got a bomb in my back pocket. My aunt has a bomb. My sister has a bomb. We all have bombs. And then you go out and you look for the bombs, and you find out that they don't have it. So the U.S. Army decided not to do it. And the defining moment to me of the one of the defining moments, the defining moral moment of the 20th century were the trials at Nuremberg, in which we said people are responsible for their actions. If you're the head of a nation and you send out your minions to kill civilians and torture people and slave and murder, you're responsible. If you're a soldier and you're told to kill, murder, and enslave and torture, you're supposed to say no. And they acknowledge that, if your lieutenant has a gun to your head and you can't say no, okay, we accept that. But if you can say no, you're supposed to say no. Otherwise, you're responsible. And this is a huge leap forward in the civilizing of humanity. And our chief prosecutor there said, we're not going to impose a standard on the Germans that we will not live up to ourselves. And he said, I was only following orders is not an excuse. And this became like a standard joke. You always had these German characters saying, I was only following orders. I was only following orders. And that was something that, Germans, dastardly Nazis did, is they would do something horrible and say, I was only following orders, but not what Americans did. And this administration actually used its legal staff to come up with a new theory for torturing. And it goes like this, that if the president thinks it's necessary to torture somebody in order to fulfill his military duties, he's not constrained by the Constitution, by international treaties, by the War Crimes Act, by international war crimes treaties, because his duty as commander-in-chief exceeds all of that. And since they didn't really expect the president to go out and commit torture with his own hands, he was going to have to order people to do it or ask other people to do it. But they needed to be protected, too. What if the president says, you know, go slice off his toes until he tells you where the bombs are? And, you know, the willing minion says, oh, sure, I'll go chop his toes. That's fun. But what if I get brought up on charges? Well, the lawyer said, if you were following orders of the commander-in-chief, of the, in his commander-in-chief capacity, then you too are outside the Constitution, outside international treaties, outside the War Crimes Act. So we have made, I was only following orders, presumably a legal defense.
And it's presumably a legal defense to say I was only giving orders if you're the president.
I'm sorry?
And it's also likewise a legally justified not to give the orders, not only to receive
them. Oh, yeah, both.
As yeah, you put I mean, it, yeah, both above him. The law and below the law.
Right. And, I mean, this is an astonishing thing. And, you know, the people who made up this theory, I mean, one's now a federal judge. Another is our attorney general. And nobody's complaining.
These are fog facts.
These are fog facts. And it was barely even brought up. This is so much a fog fact that it was not even seriously discussed when Gonzalez was being questioned to be approved for attorney general.
We're talking to Larry Beinhart today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Larry Beinhart's the novelist and writer who wrote the book Wag the Dog and also The Librarian. I'm sure many of you have seen the film Wag the Dog. He has a brand new book out that we're talking about, published by Nation Books, and I mean literally brand new, Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And before I go to a caller who's patiently waiting, let me remind you that 1 week from today, we'll have a special two-hour version of Media Matters from noon to 2. And on that show, we'll have John Nichols joining us to talk about media and politics, as John loves to do. Special two-hour version of Media Matters next week. We do hope you listen. It's our pledge drive show, and we need you to step up next week and show your support for us during that program. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Eureka, Illinois, you're on the air with Larry Beinhart.
Yes. A very short comment and question, then I'll get off the air. Fog certainly seems to fit as an accurate kind of euphemism for a lot of the nonsense that's put out by the Bush administration. My question would be, it seems to me, and you have touched it several times, that United States governmental agencies knew a lot, and I guess to me I would argue they knew a lot, and this comes up in private conversations with people about the cause of 9/11 to stop it. I remember hearing a border officer from Blaine, Washington, which is along I-5, the main corridor between, say, Seattle and Vancouver and into British Columbia, say that the biggest trouble they had is they didn't have computers that talked to each other. Might this be one of the causes? I'm sure you know a lot more. Could you elaborate on that? Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Yeah, Larry, do you know much about that?
About which?
Well, the questioner
making the computers talk to each other?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know. I'm sure that they have technical problems, but it really wasn't even an issue.
I mean, there are bigger fish to fry in trying to figure that one out.
No. I mean, obviously, I mean, one of the things that they should, again, it was, the issue really was how to pay more attention to what we already could find out. There's a whole series of again, you know, I'm looking through my own book for some of the quotes. But we could have known. And a lot of, oh, yeah, Porter Goss, who's now head of the CIA, said, quote, should we have known? Yes, we should have. Could we have known? Yes. Senator Richard Shelby, who was the ranking Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said, they, meaning the government, don't have an excuse because the information was in their lap and they didn't do anything to prevent it. Arlen Specter, who was on the Joint Intelligence Committee investigating 9/11, said, I don't believe any longer that it's a matter of connecting the dots. I think they had a veritable blueprint, and we want to know why they didn't act on it. Donald Rumsfeld said, there were lots of warnings. So, you know, part of what defines what's in the fog is your point of view. In other words, is what are you looking for? And a large reason why we didn't see 9/11 coming was that was not what this administration was looking for. And I think there were a lot of reasons for it. One of them was Bill Clinton told them to look for it. And they were so full of themselves and so contemptuous of Bill that if Bill said it, they were determined to ignore it. Another reason is that they were looking so hard at Iraq from the day they came into office. Now, there's a story that George Bush Jr. was originally contracted a different guy to write his autobiography with him. And in the conversations with that guy, and this is only has one attribution, which is one of the reasons that probably rightly it didn't make it into the mainstream media, but it sounds like so right to me, knowing people's psychologies, is that this George Bush watched his father go up to 90% or better in the approval ratings by having a war against Saddam Hussein, and then dropped down to, oh, I don't know, remember what it was, but low enough to lose to that trailer park trash from Arkansas. And so he both felt this huge elation, and then he felt a huge humiliation on his father's behalf. And he determined that when he got to be president, he would complete this task, bring glory upon himself, and thereby accumulate political capital, a phrase that he uses a great deal, and then be able to expend that political capital on getting reelected and on putting through his domestic agenda. And that's why they were looking at Iraq rather than looking at terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like conspiracy theories, which I do from time to time, more in fiction than in fact, but you can say that they were looking for a new Pearl Harbor, a phrase that occurs in the plan for the new American century, so that they could transform the country into the imperial power, the Pax Americana that they wanted it to. And so, well, when it came to worrying about a terrorist attack on the United States, they said, well, you know, gee, so what if there was one? Well, you know, we could take advantage of it and transform the country and transform the world because we'd been attacked. And in fact, that's what they did.
We're talking to Larry Beinhart today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Larry Beinhart's the novelist, author of Wag the Dog and the Librarian, has a new book out of nonfiction, Fog Facts, Searching for the Truth in the Land of Spin, published by Nation Books, just came out. We have just talked about just a smidgen of what's inside this book. I mean, I don't want people to leave this show thinking it's exclusively about Iraq or the Bush administration of 9/11. There's a lot about the Bush-Cheney administration in here, the Bush-Cheney record, but there's a lot more in here than we've spoken about. I hope we'll have a chance to get to it in the remaining 20 minutes of the show. We have a couple of callers patiently waiting. If you'd like to join them, the phone number here at Media Matters, 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And remember, next week's special show, John Nichols, noon to 2, here on WILL AM 580. Okay, back to the phone lines. Champaign County, you're on the air with Larry Beinhart.
Hi. I'll try and be short, but since you're speaking to us from Hollywood and you mentioned...
Actually, I'm speaking to you from Woodstock, New York.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well,
we got an old hippie here.
You're bi-coastal anyway, so you have to go there a lot. But you mentioned 24, and I saw the program notes for this new Pentagon drama called E-Ring, and it was about people going into Iran from Iraq and being called off. And, you know, I was thinking, well, here's something that's trying to stop... stop the move to war, but the denouement of the series was that the guy that was sent to upbraid somebody for going across into Iran was himself stranded in Iran and then saved by the person that he was scolding and telling to stop ceasing and desist. And it seemed that the moral of the story was that the U.S. troops could go wherever the H they wanted to go. So, I mean, we have that, and then we have... Arrested Development, which found its way to work the plot line into lampooning Rumsfeld going to shake hands with Saddam Hussein. They said it was a career ender to have be seen shaking his hand, and the major patriarch in the storyline is in jail for building houses for Saddam. And it was a really hilarious moment, and it informs at least there's some kind of critical thing in the culture going on. But anyway, those were just notes. I don't know if you need to waste any time on them, but I appreciate the way you started out talking about the corruption of FRIST and didn't even have to mention delay, but you sort of alluded to this insider training on both the president and the vice's part. And it's just so astonishing that they can... you know, in their straight face, talk about transparency and lack of corruption in other countries, and about how we have to stop lending money to countries that are corrupt. When you know, Halliburton is in the docket in France for bribing Nigerian officials, so it's like, you know, it takes two to tango.
Yeah, there's a section in the book on Bushonomics, and I haven't really seen. You know, I tried in the book to write stuff that I hadn't read elsewhere, or at least take it to different places, because if I'd read it already, you know, what do you need me to say it? But I have a section on Bushonomics, and I think Bushonomics is fascinating, and nobody's really examined it. It comes down to a really simple process. The goal of Bushonomics is to take money from taxpayers and give it to rich people. And that's it. And the fascinating part of it is that is the bottom line of the president's and vice president's careers. The way George Bush got rich was by taxing the people of Arlington to build a baseball stadium that was then owned by the baseball team, and then by selling the team and the stadium. And the actual amount of profit they made selling the team in the stadium is actually somewhat less than the cost of building the stadium plus the cost of the team. So the way and George Bush put in, if I remember correctly, $500,000 and walked away with $13 million. But that $13 million is money that came directly from the people of Arlington. It was not by improving the product. It was not by coming up with a great idea. So the way George Bush got rich is by taking taxpayer money and putting it in his own pocket. And
no, you're not going to accuse Vice President Cheney of that, too, are you, Larry?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the way Halliburton gets rich is by taking no-bid contracts, and which the government pays for, which means our tax dollars pay for it. And I mean, Cheney also has an interesting career, because he was a guy who never engaged in private business in his life. He spent an entire lifetime in government employment, except for two or three years as a repairman for a Wyoming telephone company. And now he's worth in the range of $44 million. So where did that money come from? And money came basically from Halliburton stock. And why did he have Halliburton stock? Well, there are two stories. His story is that the retiring chairman of Halliburton was so impressed with him while they were off on a hunting trip that he said, "Hey, Dick, I'm going to make you the head of my company." I think the story is more has got to do with the revolving door. That when Dick Cheney was Secretary of the Army, he said, "Hey, what if we privatized the Army?" And he hired Halliburton to perform a study, and he paid them to perform a study of how to privatize the Army. And he apparently liked their recommendations so much that he then hired Halliburton to do that privatization. And this is business worth unlimited billions of dollars. Unlimited billions of dollars. So if you were a cynical person who believes that politicians get paid off, you would say, "Hey, this is the way we do our payoffs nowadays. Is after you leave office, the people who you did business with then put you in a position to get unbelievably wealthy." Do we have another caller?
Yeah, we sure do. Larry Benhart, before we go to the next caller, let me ask you, I mean, do you think that the situation with Fog Facts today, in the last few years, is worse than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago? Or do you think
sure.
This is okay.
Oh, yeah, hugely worse. Hugely
how come?
Worse. There's a variety of reasons. Reason number one is that corporations invested a lot of money on public relations that they had not invested in before. And public relations and selling information to the media grew up. And they're very good at it. And then the politicians learned from the people who are now in the business of manufacturing news to sell to the media. And the media didn't grow up with them. They didn't learn how to... And the public is only slowly beginning to grow up with them. So a new sophistication was created in the business of selling information. At the same time, the media became increasingly corporate and increasingly bottom line, so that they began to judge the news more and more by not how nutritious the product was, but how many people ate it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the most insightful piece of work is about how the media functions. It's actually a movie called Supersize Me, which is about McDonald's. And this is, you know, a little bit sideways thinking, but here's a guy who went out and demonstrated that by eating McDonald's, you get fat and ugly and die. All right? And yet people go to McDonald's, and everybody knows that McDonald's is really nutritious and it's really not good for you, and yet people continue to do it. It's because it pushes buttons in us that evolved in us before we were rational. And people running television news and even newspaper news have gradually learned about our buttons. And if it comes to a choice between providing us with nutritious news, things that we really ought to know and that really explain things, and providing us with news that will push our buttons and keep us watching television or keep us buying their paper, they have to. They have to give us the button pushers because they have to bring in the profits.
We're talking to Larry Benhart today on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line two, thank you for your patience in Urbana. You're on the air with Larry Benhart.
Yeah, no problem. That Fog Facts sounds really good. I just had a quick question that was prompted from what I understand is a recent article in PR Watch about David Horowitz, which apparently asks the question, is David Horowitz the new McCarthy, which is kind of relevant because George Clooney is coming out with his new movie, Good Night and Good Luck, about Edward R. Murrow. And Horowitz apparently is having the Students for Academic Freedom investigate professors as to their party affiliations and, you know, kind of report them. And I was wondering if your guest had a better nominee as to the new McCarthy. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, caller. Yeah, Larry, we maybe have an idea for another book for you here.
The new McCarthy.
So are you following David Horowitz and all this sort of stuff?
Yeah, a little bit. But I mean, the interesting thing is, in a sense, there is almost, or has been, until now, almost no opposition to this right-wing dominance, or what I believe to be right-wing dominance, of the media and of the government.
You don't think the Democrats have put up much of a fight?
They didn't put up any fight. I mean, this was the roll over and play dead semi-decade,
mm-hmm.
And it's well, you know, historically, what's happened is communism died, so everybody figures if it died, it died for good reasons because it was no good, and therefore the winner, which was capitalism, is good. So anything about capitalism is good. And anything about fighting the enemy is good. And so there is no countervailing anything. Not that I want to go back to Soviet domination of anywhere. Some of my best friends, as we like to say, are from Eastern Europe, and they wouldn't like it. But what happened is that the right-wing ideologies then had an open field and have run rampant. And there was nothing there's no real way to define against them until they had the chance to prove that there was something very dysfunctional about what they're doing. Frankly, I think that, I get to this to some degree in the book, is that the old definitions, liberal conservative, don't really work anymore. The new definition of between the faith-based and the reality-based. And it's only after you let the faith-based people run things for a while that you can see that running things on the basis of faith doesn't work. That is, prayer did not stop New Orleans from flooding. Being instructed by God to go to war in Iraq did not make the Iraq war successful. Believing in the gospel according to Adam Smith, or Smithianity.
By the way, let me interject for those just tuning in. Larry Beinhart, the author of Fog Facts, our guest, has a discussion of free market economics, specifically Adam Smith, which is really outstanding and worth the book. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Adam Smith was a great philosopher. He's one of those hard-headed Scots pragmatists. I mean, he's really, and you read his stuff, and it's really great stuff. But then people took this phrase, the invisible hand, and well, if there's an invisible hand guiding things to make things all come out right, that's like God. And they believed that free market capitalism was the hand of God. And so they believe in it irrationally. And the reason they hate Roosevelt and Social Security is the same reason they hate Darwin and evolution. It's because it contradicts a belief in God. It shows that human tinkering could actually work better than the invisible hand. But anyway, I have no idea where this started.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've only got a minute or two left, Larry Beinhart. You know, I read your book, or someone reads it. What do you want to come out of this book? I mean, you alert people. Is there hope to change this, to sort of lift the fog, so to speak, and have a political culture in which some stronger sense of context and truth emerges and facts aren't hidden in the fog?
Yeah, you know, there is one place in which, again, you know, my feeling is it's reality versus faith. And there's one place in which the news media has taken on the real responsibility of objective journalism, which is to say, this guy's telling the truth, that guy's lying. And they do it now routinely when people run political advertisements. Somebody will run a political advertisement, and your local newspaper, New York Times, I've seen it in the LA Times, I've seen it in various other places, I've even seen it on television, will then dissect that advertisement. And they'll say, this advertisement is 70% true. First line is true, second line is an unjustified allegation, the third line is an actual lie, but then the concluding four sentences are accurate and correct. And they do not rely on there being a loyal opposition to do that. And if the news media will take this and apply it to all news situations, yeah, we can have real news. And in order for them to want to do that, it's up to us to demand it. It's up to us to not eat fast food news and say we want nutritious news.
Larry Beinhart, are you working on another novel or a screenplay at this point?
I am working on a nonfiction book.
A nonfiction book?
Another nonfiction book, yeah. This one was so much fun, I said I've got to do another one.
Is it on media again?
No, this one's on religion.
All right. Well, Larry Beinhart is our guest today on Media Matters. He's been discussing his new book, Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin. Beinhart's the author of Wag the Dog and The Librarian. Larry, what do you consume for your media diet?
I use the internet. I read the New York Times. I love Jon Stewart. And once every 2 weeks, I watch the network news for maybe 15 or 20 minutes. I mean, the great thing about television news is you can watch it once a year and you know what it's about.
And what on the internet, what websites do you like to go to?
I like BuzzFlash because they just direct me to lots of other stories in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Mainstream media, actually, if you're looking for facts, mainstream media digs out a lot of facts and then just lets them lay there.
Mm-hmm.
So I go there. I'll look at Common Dreams. I'll look at Alternet. I'll sometimes cruise right-wing websites, that sort of thing. And I read the New York Times every morning at breakfast.
Larry Beinhart has been our guest today on Media Matters. Larry is the author, as I've said, of the new book, Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin, just published by Nation Books. It's been a pleasure having you, Larry, joining us today.
Thank you very much, Bob.
And good luck with the book. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I'm going to be back in 166 hours, not 167 as usual, because next week we've got our special two-hour pledge drive show. We're going to have John Nichols joining us from The Nation and the Cap Times up in Madison, Wisconsin, discussing the state of politics in the United States today and the state of media. Should be a great show. It's our pledge drive show. We've got an unbelievably good premium, by my opinion. So please do join us a week from today. I want to thank John Anderson for sitting in as producer today. Andrew Boyle is on assignment up in Chicago this weekend. I want to thank Brett Polson for being the engineer. And I'll see you all 166 hours from now. Bye-bye.
Bob.
We can bring you Media Matters because of contributions from the friends of WILL. By June 30th, we must raise $900,000 in listener support in order to bring you the programs you expect from us. Join others who believe WILL is an important community resource when our fall fund drive begins on Saturday. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the lower 60s and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-40s and northeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.com.